evening, everyone, and welcome to this town hall. My name is Randy Stufflebeam, and I'll be your host this evening. And obviously, our star of tonight is Daryl Castle, the Constitution Party presidential candidate. And tonight, it's primarily just to kind of get a feel for who Daryl is and kind of where he stands on some of the positions. We've asked some folks what some questions are that they might have, and so we'll be leading on to some other questions. I'll have a few of my own, and we'll just kind of get right into it. Good evening, Mr. Castle. Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you here, and look forward to having this little dialogue to find out a little bit more about you.
Sure. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, you know, one of the things that we have in common is that we were both Marines, and I know you did a little stint in the service. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Well, unlike you, I only spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. I spent all four of my years as a lieutenant, 18 months as a second lieutenant, and the rest of it as a first lieutenant. I served many places all over the world, and it was a great learning experience for me. I learned a lot about leadership, about the country, about the leadership of the country. And it changed me for the better, I think. It opened my eyes about some things.
So you'd probably say that you have a clue about what the purpose of the military is all about then?
Well, I know, yes, I think I have a clue about what the purpose of the military is about. It's about defending this country and our way of life.
And you were born in Tennessee, or?
Well, yes. I come from a family of small farmers. I was born in 1948 on a small farm in East Tennessee, a subsistence farm. That just means that we raised what we needed to eat to live and nothing else. We didn't sell food, we just raised it for ourselves. And we didn't owe anybody anything, so it was a pretty good way of life. But that's how I grew up. So I said 1948, which means I'm more than 35 years old, and it was in Tennessee, so I am constitutionally qualified for the office I seek, at least in that regard.
Well, and you got involved with the Constitution Party back in its foundings in 1992.
I did. I was introduced to Howard Phillips, who was the actual founder. It was Howard's idea. Howard was in the Nixon administration, and he was held a very responsible position in the Nixon administration, and he had come to the conclusion that the Democrat and Republican parties were never going to take the nation where we wanted it to go. He told me these things, and I met Howard, and he and I and several other men kind of put this party together and started it. It was Howard's baby. He was the actual founder, but my wife Joan and I went down to New Orleans that first year as Tennessee delegates to the National Convention, the first National Convention. So this is the seventh presidential election that we've been involved in since its founding in 1992.
Well, we had a little Constitution Party meeting this afternoon with the Missouri Party, and you know, they had a pretty good time, and I heard you speak there, and you mentioned a little bit about limited government. Can you tell us what that means? I mean, you know, some people are a little bit afraid of what limited government is, and you know, shouldn't we be afraid? What was the overall perspective, and what should Americans really understand about that?
Well, I want people to understand what political power is. The founders were afraid of political power. They wanted it to be limited. They knew that no one can be trusted with it, not even them, and certainly not even me. So they wanted it to be limited. So they put together, they constituted a written document that would serve as a written limit on political power. And what do I mean by that? Well, political power is the legal privilege that government has to use brute force against anyone, even people who haven't done anything wrong. And the way our country is looks at itself today, our leadership can use that power against anyone in the world that they see fit. That is very dangerous, and it has to be limited. It has to be limited by something solid, something in writing, and that is the Constitution. Those people that formed the country knew that that power was dangerous, that no one could be trusted with it. So they only entrusted the federal government with 17 enumerated powers that they set out, and they reserved everything else to the states. So when I say limited government, I mean limiting the federal government's power to use brute force by what the Constitution specifically says.
How does limited government actually benefit Americans, though?
Well, I mean, how would unlimited government benefit them? The opposite of limited government, obviously, is unlimited government, which many people might say is what we have now. So people would be free, freer. Government, they would not be subject to arbitrary government power all the time. And they would know what the limits were. They would know, for example, what the Constitution says, what government can do and what government can't do. Right now, we have leadership who seem to think that they have absolute power to do whatever they want to do. That's very dangerous in my view, and it should be curtailed, it should be limited. And people who, especially the office of president, people who seek to enter that office should have some understanding of the constitutional limits of what that office can do.
Well, speaking of kind of what those limits are, it kind of goes into our first person who asked the question. Cindy Redburn from Missouri asked and mentioned that you often talk about the rule of law. And, you know, what does that mean exactly? And how has the rule of law been violated, and what can we do about that?
Well, the rule of law, of course, goes back to the Constitution, because the Constitution says that it is the supreme law of the land. And it's pretty simple, really, if you take it, what's have come to be kind of cliches. We are a nation of laws, not of men. We're all created equal, things like that. All those things are kind of out the window now. The rule of law, quite simply, means that no one is above the law's sanction, and no one is beneath the law's protection. The law serves us all equally. That's what it means. Now, an example of how it's been violated, the most recent example, the most obvious example that I can think of is the long investigation of Mrs. Clinton's email affair and to some extent her foundation. And it seems there was overwhelming evidence that she had committed crimes for which ordinary people would have been sent to prison for. I could cite several instances where people have done far less, specific cases where they have been criminally sanctioned. In fact, the director of the FBI, Mr. Comey, actually said in his news conference, he actually admitted that if someone not similarly situated, I think is the way you phrase it, not similarly situated, had done these things, then an indictment probably would have been forthcoming. So to me, that said, we now have two sets of laws, one for people like that and one for little people like us. So that's a clear violation of the rule of law, and we need to change that, because I'm afraid that when the American people come to the conclusion that there are two sets of laws, that the law doesn't apply to them. That's obviously what they think, the leadership, I mean. When that becomes generally accepted in the public, I'm afraid the results might not be pleasant.
This may seem a little flippant, and I don't mean for it to be, because it just seems like a national progression of this question is, you know, you mentioned there's the rule of law for some and a rule of law for others. Where would you put yourself in?
Well, I suppose when I say rule of law for all, I mean that obviously includes me. The rule of law just means that from the President of the United States to the homeless veteran sleeping in your park, the law applies to all of us equally. That is the idea.
Okay. In the rule of law, there's certain things that the rule of law should really specifically apply to, and maybe some things that it shouldn't. And there's the great debate. There's a little bit of diversity here. Grant Broadhurst from Florida asked, is it the government's job to enforce moral behavior?
Well, that is something that my first inclination is to say no to. But when you really think about it, everything we do from a governmental standpoint is an enforcement of morality. To say that government shouldn't enforce morality is ridiculous when you understand that every criminal statute on the books is an enforcement of morality. If you make a law against rape, isn't that an enforcement of morality? I mean, who says we can't rape each other? Obviously, that's a moral law, same with murder or any other crime. At the same time, if the person is actually asking me, do you think the federal government should make prostitution illegal nationally? Well, no, I don't. I mean, that's a state matter, and it should be handled by state criminal statutes. So the answer to that question, I mean, I'm not trying to be evasive. The answer is simply yes and no. But generally, yes, because obviously the government enforces a standard of morality in our country through its criminal sanctions. It decides what is destructive of our society. It decides what will be crimes, what will not be crimes.
Is there a difference, and you kind of hit on it, is there a difference between what the federal government should be doing and what the states specifically do? I think you hit it a little bit, but could you expound on that a little
absolutely.
Bit?
Absolutely. I mean, as I said a minute ago, the federal government is limited to what it can do. It's exceeded those limits tremendously. Right now, there are over 4,000 federal crimes for which you can be snatched off the street and locked up. Most of those should be state matters. There should be very few federal crimes, in my view. So, if you want to look at it like that, most morality should be enforced at the state level. The Constitution clearly defines what federal murder statutes would be, treason, things of that nature. But we're constantly looking for different things that people can be sanctioned for. And it sounds kind of flippant, as you put it a minute ago, but I'm afraid we'll reach a point, if we're not careful, where everything is either required or prescribed. You know, you're either required to do it or you're prohibited from doing it, so that we're not free to just walk around in our lives and make our own decisions and live our own lives and so forth.
Well, I know one of the biggest, in fact, for the Constitution Party, their very first plank is the sanctity of life. And I know that you have some pretty strong feelings about the abortion issue. The questioner, in fact, it was several people have asked the question, so it kind of revolves around how do you plan to stop abortion within the confines of the office of the president as they opposed it?
Well, first of all, once again, I'll point you back to the abuse of political power. There are certain powers that should not be granted to government, and one of those powers is the right to decide who is and is not a person. I mean, the Supreme Court, in its Roe decisions and following decisions, admitted that if the unborn were persons, then it would be unconstitutional, because the Fifth Amendment says no person may be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. The 14th Amendment uses the same language and applies that language to the states. So there is no doubt that that persons have the right to life. So the question becomes, what is a person? In my speech today, I went into that a little bit more in depth than what I have now. But my point right now is, it's a power that should not be granted to the government. So what to do about it? Well, one thing a president can do is he can veto and resist all funding for Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. That's one thing. Probably the one of the greatest things he could do is do his best to educate the American people on what abortion is. This is an aborted baby. You know, this was a living child a few minutes ago, but this woman was able to quite legally pay her doctor to kill this child. The argument is always taken away from the central issue. The argument is a woman's right to choose, but the real argument, the central issue, is a dead baby. So there are some other things that a president could do. He could appoint pro-life U.S. attorneys in all of the federal districts. That's another thing you could do, but Congress is the real issue here, and the Constitution, if people are worried about the Supreme Court, let's say that the states started passing various pro-life bills. The states decided to exercise their 10th Amendment right to prohibit people from killing unborn children. In those cases, obviously, people would file suit, and those cases would work their way up through the federal courts, and the Supreme Court would say, no, we've been over this before. So Congress has the right, if it wants to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. In fact, all federal courts, Congress constitutionally can tell the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, that you do not have the right to rule in abortion cases or any other jurisdictional matter they wanted. If Congress wanted, for example, to tell the federal courts that they have no jurisdiction in the area of marriage or any other area you want to talk about, they could do that. Now, to my knowledge, that's never been done, but it was put in the Constitution for a reason. The reason was obviously to give Congress some authority over the federal courts. So that might be something that a president could use as an embarrassing thing for Congress, because the president, I'm not going to do something illegal and issue an executive order for this or that, because I believe that executive orders are unconstitutional. And as Dr. Paul said when he was a candidate, that the only one he would issue would be the one that withdrew all the others that had been issued. But those are some things that a president could do. I guess more than anything else, just stop encouraging it. Stop influencing people to kill their children. Stop telling them it's okay. Start telling them, look, this is a living human being you're killing. And maybe God would take his hand of judgment off this country for the 60 million unborn children that we've already killed.
You know, you've mentioned the Supreme Court on several occasions throughout your definition there. And a lot of people, right now, we do have the situation where there's a seat up for appointment. And the question from our, I think some Facebook followers actually, asked, who would you appoint?
Well, I've said that I would offer that seat to my dear friend, Herb Titus. Some of you may know Herb. I've known him for 30 years, maybe. He's a dear friend. He's a Harvard lawyer. You got to have a Harvard person on the Supreme Court. He's a constitutional scholar. He was dean of Regent University Law School. I can't think of anybody I would trust more to be in that position. Now, let's say that Mr. Titus said, thank you, but I have to spend more time with my family. Perhaps Judge Roy Moore would be a good person. There are many other people that I can think of if the opportunity came along. Judge Napolitano, maybe, perhaps, and he's somebody to be considered, but Herb would be my first choice. Now, I've never talked to Herb. I don't know if he would accept the appointment or not, but I think he would.
Well, that kind of flows into the next question, because a lot of people think that there should be some term limits. What's your view on term limits? Not just Supreme Court issue or whatever, but all offices.
Well, I sympathize with people who have that view. I really do. I don't hold the view myself. I take the position that people just need to vote right. They need to learn to have the courage to go in and say, I'm going to term limit you out with my vote. I do understand it. I understand the principle, and I respect people who feel that way. I was talking to a gentleman the other day, and we were having this discussion, and he said, but the American people are stupid. They're too stupid to vote these people out. I said, well, with all due respect, I beg to disagree. I don't think the American people are stupid, and I think they can vote what they want in office. It is interesting. I remember back in 2008, there were lots of turmoil in the country. I was a candidate for vice president that year. Lots of things were going on. President Obama was running his first time in his first election for the office of president. And every single congressman was up for re-election in 2008. Most of you remember those days when there were so many things changing in the country. Every single congressman was up for 435, I think it is, and eight of them were not re-elected. So people don't vote, but the long and short of it is, that's my view anyway. But once again, term limits is something that would have to be done through constitutional amendment, and the president really has nothing to do with it.
The next question is kind of a shift here, and I'm going to first read the question and then kind of maybe interpret it a little bit. It has to do with education. And Joe Chang asked, how about experimenting on our school children with learning projects that take as much as 15 years to find out if it works? Now, I'm not sure if this was on his mind, but trying to really capture the essence of the question, you know, one of the big things out there is Common Core. We've had some other types of systems that have been implemented that really just don't seem to be maybe working. And so how long, and you know, what's your opinion on some of these processes, and you know, what's the federal government's role in education?
Well, to say that they're not working, you're a master of understatement, because no offense, but our kids get dumber every year. There's scientific evidence for that. I'm not just making it up. I mean, we rank 36 worldwide in math and science this year. No one else comes even close to spending as much money per child as we do. 36 in math and science. Third world countries that beg us on their knees for money are beating us. So that's not the only reason. That's just a result of the reason. I'm opposed to any federal role in education whatsoever. I would like to see the Department of Education. Now, keep in mind that we existed as a nation and led the world for most of this time in education, and many of those areas that I just talked about in math and science, certainly. We put people on the moon before we had a Department of Education. We did a lot of things before we had the Department of Education. It was Jimmy Carter's administration that made it a cabinet level position. So I would like to disband it, and I would like to return education to the state, local, and family level. In other words, I would like to see families free to educate their children as they saw fit. And I believe it would be much, much better if states, and they have a 10th Amendment right to do this in my view, but states, if the people of a state of Missouri, let's say, wanted to have public schools and the state fund them and, with people's taxes, more power to them. But if the states wanted to go to a lower level than that, more power to them. I'm all for defunding federal education. I think it's been a terrible disaster, and you can point to many, many of the bad things that have happened to our country in the last 30, 40 years to that.
Trying to go through a little different level, I was trying to keep these a little bit kind of associated, kind of in a grouping here. The next question has to deal with the military and with war and basically the use of our armed forces. The question from Aaron Davis from Tennessee says, would you use the word mistake for our military interventions in either Afghanistan or Iraq? And he makes a statement, conflicts where thousands of U.S. servicemen and women died bravely to defend America.
Well, that's the gentleman's view. They died to defend America. And I'm sure that was their view at the time. I'm not sure it's true, to be honest. Let me answer the question like this. I love the military. I'm a military man. I come from a military family. My two brothers, one served in World War II, one served in Korea. So I have a tremendous respect for the military, and the fact that I love them and respect them so much is one reason why I would use their lives a lot more dearly than our leadership today. It goes back to political power. I know I sound like a parrot, but the fact is, political power has to be constrained. Presidents today view themselves as emperor of the world. Their brute force is not over just us innocent people, it's the whole world. And we really need to look at that. Hindsight's 20/20, so me to look back at the invasion of Afghanistan and say that was a mistake, it seems like a mistake. Iraq too. I mean, think of all the things that would be good now if we hadn't done those things. All the people that would still be alive. We did kill thousands of servicemen, or lose them rather. Who knows how many Iraqis and Afghans were killed, but they do. God knows, because he hears every one of their cries. I'm against war, not always. I understand that it's necessary at times. It's certainly better than slavery, but I am abjectly opposed to sticking our nose into every rattlesnake's nest that pops up around the world. Maybe someday, if I live long enough, there will be a war somewhere and we'll just pass on it and say, hey, that one's on you. You know, we'll pass on this one. I don't mean to be flippant about so serious a subject. I'm a non-interventionist, but I would defend this country to the last drop of blood if I had to, but only if I have to.
Well, one of the issues kind of that's been prevalent over the past quite a few months, as it were, is ISIS. Now, would that be a good use of our military force to go after those kind of people that are doing such heinous crimes?
They're bad people, it seems. That's for sure. I don't see how we can justify going after them when our border's wide open to them. Come right on in to anybody, not knowing whether he's a terrorist or anything else. So first step, secure the border. Don't tell me you're fighting terrorism in Syria when you're importing Syrians into the United States, number one. And number two, your borders are wide open. You have no idea who's coming across. So secure the borders. Whether it's necessary to go abroad looking for terrorists to slay, you know, that's hard for me sitting here in the Stone Castle Hotel in Branson, Missouri, to answer, to be perfectly candid about it. There are 16 intelligence agencies that service this country. Their job is to go out around the world and gather information and report it back to the president. I don't have access to that information, but the president does. There are many heads of the armed forces of the country who also assess their needs, and they report back to the commander-in-chief. Until I had a briefing from those people, how am I to know where the real threats to this country are? So I would not hesitate to use the armed forces to defend America if it were really necessary, but tell me, if you want to fight terrorism, tell me we have secure borders. Then if we need to go fight them, we can do that.
Switching now to some domestic issues. The next issue is federal lands from Melanie McDonald from Connecticut. She asked, Mr. Castle, will you return land to the states that was stolen by the use of the Antiquities Act, and will you get rid of the Bureau of Land Management?
Yes. That's one of our...
Yes to both?
That's yes to both. That's one of our major issues. Some people don't know this, but the federal government actually owns 90% of Nevada. In other words, if Nevada applied for statehood today, it would not have enough sovereign territory to be accepted. In Wyoming, I think it's about 70%. Many other states of the West have the same problem. It's true in the East, too. President Obama is in the process of trying to set aside several million acres in Maine right now. So it's a big problem. And yes, one of our things, when I say our, I mean my running mate, Scott Bradley, is from Utah. And he's very up to speed on the land issues in the West. That's one reason why I wanted him. So one of our primary tasks is states into the people.
Alrighty. This is a kind of an interesting one, and I like this question because it's about future voters. From D. Akala, let's see, let me get the, see, I had it down. Akala Tawaks from Florida. I'm sorry, D. I had your name down, I thought, earlier. Anyway, she asks, what would the future for younger voters look like under your presidency as compared to under the Republican, Democrat, and Libertarian?
So what's her first name?
D.
D. Well, I see D's comments quite often on Facebook, so I wanted to thank her for that, for constantly posting. What would it look like? Better, I think, in many different ways. I mean, I think they would be freer. If I were elected president, they could keep their income. That's something to talk about, because my tax proposals, if they were accepted, would allow them to do that. I think they would be able to spend their lives possibly not mired in debt slavery, you know, like the Bible says, the borrower becomes a slave of the lender. So right now, most of them owe tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars to the federal government. So who are they slaves to? All those reasons and many others, I think young people, I love the people of this country. I really do. I respect them, and especially young people, because it's the future. I have a 32-year-old daughter. The future belongs to them, and it's our task to leave them a better country to live in, a freer country, not one that's constantly, relentlessly marching toward more and more federal control, more and more political power, but more and more control of power. And I think they would find it a better life. Also, there'd be jobs. As the economy grew, tremendous amounts of income were released into the economy through the taxes that are now confiscated by the government. Think about it like this. What person of ordinary means can live on one person's income and provide for a household? What family can do that? Not many. One person works to pay the bills. One person works to pay the government. I'd like to see that change, and I think young people would benefit from it.
Well, that's a great segue into the next question. It's about your tax plan. The question is, what do you think of the concept of a national sales tax as opposed to the income tax, and what is your tax plan?
Well, I like the fair tax, as we've come to call it. I like it better than I do the income tax. I mean, it's kind of a use or pays type of deal, you know. It would obviously drive the cost of everything up, and I worry about it for various reasons. You're still giving the federal government the right to tax you. And if the sales tax or the fair tax, whatever you want to call it, started out at, say, 15% this year, my fear would be that next year it'd be 20. There's no control by the states over what the federal government is doing. But as I said, I like it better than I do what we have now. But at the same time, what I am trying to do, what I would like to do, is use what I call a constitutional tax, which is kind of set out in the Constitution. It says in its original wording, before we amended it with the 16th Amendment and gave the federal government the right to tax our incomes, the Constitution said that there would be no direct tax by the federal government on the American people. No direct tax. And somehow we lived for a while before we did that. We lived until 1913 before we changed that. And we fought some wars in there, did all kinds of things. But so what I would propose to do is have a tax that is apportioned, as the Constitution says, as per the census. In other words, if Missouri had 1% of the nation's population, Missouri would be responsible for collecting 1% of the budget. And so it would be incumbent upon the people of Missouri, through their representatives in Congress, to make sure that Congress did not pass a $4 trillion budget. The states would be empowered. Washington would be disempowered. power would be flowing back to the states and to the people. And the states would not be coming to Washington on their knees saying, please give us the money to fund all the mandates that you've placed on us. Please give us the money to try to undo the damage that you've caused. My state of Tennessee, for example, I believe I'm right about this, is the third most dependent state in the country on federal money. Our governor, coincidentally, by a strange coincidence, just changed his mind and said now he's all about accepting Syrian refugees. He wants more of them, he says. You know, one wonders if there's a connection. But if we had that constitutional tax I was talking about, that would not be the case. And the power would return to where it belongs, where it was originally intended in the Constitution, back to the states and to the people. Now, I could go further with that and say that there would be lots of things. You know, the federal government would not be, well, let me just stop right there because I was about to go into something that the federal government is constantly doing to our children that it shouldn't be doing. That might be best served for another question.
All right, got two questions from Gilda. And the first one from her is, if I vote for you, can you guarantee that you will not forget God in your decision making?
Well, I love old Gilda. She's a dear friend. And I hope she understands that I would not forget God. God wouldn't let me do that. If I were elected president, he would be the one who put me there. And as the old fathers used to say to their son, I brought you into this world, I can take you out. So God would have placed me in office. He rules in the affairs of men. And he's very important to me, very important. Every day that I live, he gets more important. So I don't think you have to worry about that, Gilda.
Well, and the next one she asks is something that both of us can really, I think, understand because of the importance that when we joined the military, we had to give an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I think both you and I understand that, you know, since our time in the military, it's actually become more important to us more than ever. And because we've come to understanding what all that means. But she asks, will you uphold the Constitution and all that it stands for? And could you put that maybe into light of, you know, the idea that, and I think one of the reasons why the question is because it seems we have every congressman, every senator, that they've made virtually the same oath that me and you did when we joined the military, but yet something seems awry. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, political power corrupts the mind and the morals. Most of them take those oaths, and my guess is that they don't even listen to it. They just hold their hand and say yes. You know, the president takes an oath. He doesn't take an oath to the American people, to defend the American people. He doesn't take an oath to defend the nation. He takes an oath to protect, preserve, and defend the United States Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Name me the last one that actually took that oath seriously. Search your memory. So, yes, I would endeavor, as God gives me the strength to do it, to uphold my oath. Maybe over the course of our lives, when we went into the military or something, we raised our hand and took the oath. We were intending to do this, to hold this office. And once again, we heard what the gentleman said when he gave us the oath, but did it really sink in on us? You know, we had an exercise a few years ago I was in when we actually went back and read what we had sworn to do, and it was pretty frightening. But yes, I would take that oath before God and the American people. It would be very meaningful to me.
Well, and kind of the last question that I have on the slate, we may move into a little bit different discussion, but it kind of is associated with that idea is because we've seen so many congressmen, senators, state representatives, state senators, and even we could point to some presidential candidates that, you know, it seems that there's a level of corruption there. And the question that I have for you is, and it's kind of what Gilda, I think, is somewhat driving at, is how are you going to stand when all others failed? And so what makes you different than your Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green Party, all the other candidates? What would make you, you know, separate yourself from them? And how would that look, you know, to the American people?
Well, how am I different? As I said before, and I repeat it, political power corrupts the mind and the morals. No one can control it. In one sense, I'm not any different. In that sense, you know, political power is not resistible by any human, including me. The founders understood this. They knew human nature. You know, the Bible says that the human heart is black and desperately wicked. Who can know it? It has to be restrained by a written document, and the people have got to enforce that document. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the founders, they talked a lot about virtue in public office. If you read the Federalist Papers and other writings, you'll see that mentioned all through there. But they did not give us a self-enforcing document. They did not give us a way to keep vice from supplanting virtue in the public square. And so that is exactly what's happened today. Virtue and our leaders, whatever you want to call them, have come up with many clever ways to destroy virtue in public affairs and in us. So one might say another way of looking at it is, don't just point to me. The American political system is corrupt because we're corrupt. We allow it. Therefore, we are complicit in their crimes. I would endeavor to uphold my oath and to be limited by the Constitution, as I pledge to you to do, and it would be up to you to make sure that that's the case.
So, one other question I kind of is an interesting question, and it's the question from this person was, why haven't you sought out CNN and many of these other news media to be interviewed and put up there, you know, and broadcast as you are a Constitution Party candidate running for president?
Well, I just chewed out my campaign manager, Joan, for all the CNN requests for interviews that she's turned down during this campaign. No, the fact is that when you have a message like mine that says we want to limit political power to its constitutional limits, its constitutional delegated enumerated powers, that's not a message that political power wants to hear. And most of the mass media today, in my view, is a wholly owned subsidiary of power. They're there for whatever power is in effect, from whichever party it is. You know, they protect President Obama, they protect Hillary Clinton, but they protected George Bush too. I remember those days. They were in lockstep with him on what he did. Yes, they don't want to hear my message, and so they don't. They just have the option of, the gentleman at CNN, what's his name, refresh my memory, the newscaster.
I want to say Wolf, but...
It's not Wolf Blitzer. Somebody help me. Cooper.
Cooper, yeah, there you go.
He's done interviews, televised interviews with Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, and many, many people have written him to try to get him to do the same for me, but he has declined that opportunity. So mainstream media is tough. They cannot keep you from buying media. But in order to buy media, you have to have money to buy media. So if everybody out there in America that wants me on the mass media, send me about $1,000 and I'll see what I can do. But for now, they're turning me down left and right.
There's a large, in fact, it's the majority of Americans are not engaged in the political process. They're not out there voting. I mean, Illinois just the last voting 2 years ago, they hit a record low. I believe that the number was like somewhere around in the 20s in terms of the percentages of voters turning out to vote. Totally record low. That means nearly 70% of the voters didn't vote, decide to come out. What would you say to them as a reason to really engage in the process, and why they should probably take a look at you and you know, be willing to step out and vote for change?
Well, or difference? If 70% of them are totally apathetic, who can blame them? If your choice is Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, yeah, I'd be pretty apathetic about that myself. But that's not your choice. You have another choice. The fact is, I'm on the ballot in 25 states, I believe, as a party. But in 23 others, people could vote for me by just writing my name. That's the only requirement. You have to be able to write my name. So it is possible. It's possible. It's within God's power that I could wake up on Wednesday morning, the 9th of November, and be president, and Joan would be first lady. And she's told me many times about, she dreams about flying off to Paris on Air Force Ones and shop and stuff like that. No, she's a very modest woman. She would not be interested in things like that. But the point is, the people could enact a bloodless revolution if they wanted to. And it would be a revolution. People could enact a quiet revolution and the world would be turned upside down. You know, there aren't many bloodless revolutions. Most are like the French Revolution, which tore France apart in 1789. And today, all these years later, France is still a secular country. Our revolution was not a bloodless revolution, but it resulted in one of the greatest experiments in the history of mankind. You know, man has spent 6,000 years on this earth that he has been able to record. Anything other than that, there was no written language, but for 6,000 years, man has recorded his time on the earth. Only 240 years of that has been in a constitutional republic like this. We should not just throw that away in a cavalier fashion. It's really the blink of an eye in all of history. And from day one, when it first started, people have been trying to destroy it. Political power has been trying to burst its restraints. So I would certainly encourage people, if there was ever going to be a time when you came out, when you got off your couch, you turned off your football game, or whatever it is you do, you come out and you vote. And you vote for Darryl Castle. And I'll try to make sure you're glad you did.
One last question for you. And I've been asked this when I ran for office. You as a Constitution Party candidate would be pretty kind of lonesome, as it were, in terms of party support and that sort of thing, because there's just not that many constitutionalists that are elected. How would you be able to work with the Republicans and Democrats to fulfill the obligations necessary to run this country?
Well, that's a fair question. It is lonely out here, but I have my dear wife, who's been by my side for 38 years. She travels with me. We're like a team, and if someone wants me to come, they hopefully understand that includes her. But how would I work with the Democrats and Republicans? Well, if I were elected, you can bet there'd be a sea change across America, because people know what I stand for, and if they elected me, they would be approving of the things that I told them, and that would mean that there'd be a lot of Democrats and Republicans going home after that election, and there'd be some constitutionally minded people coming in. Maybe there'd be some Republicans who are constitutionally minded. There are plenty of them out there. I've met several of them since I've been campaigning. You know, they could be reelected or elected. But you said that there aren't many constitutionalists in office, which is a shame. In a perfect world, no American would ever vote for someone who was not a constitutionalist again, because they should all be constitutionalists. That is the foundation. It's the charter of liberty. It's what gives this country its guaranteed liberty. It's what makes us different from all those other countries that call themselves democracies. Ours is different. So, yes, it's lonely, but if I were the only person and they were all Democrats and Republicans, you know, I'm still the president and they still have to get their stuff by me or override it. And, you know, I would just appeal to the American people. Look, you elected me. You need to get on your horses and ride. Help me run this country like it's supposed to be run.
All righty, folks. Well, that's all the time we got tonight. It's been a real pleasure of mine and an honor to be able to interview Derek. I hope you've been able to get a feel for, you know, some of the major stances that are important, that most people are asking these questions and finding out how our presidential candidate, Darrell Castle, stands on those issues.